Lesson 7 is about the United Kingdom. One of the great topics in the Bible is the topic of the kingdom, and we will, depending on how much time we have, say some additional things about that towards the end of class. But when you think about the nation of Israel, it was a nation that had a kingdom. As you look at the kingdom, it was united for 120 years. You have three kings, Saul, David, Solomon, each one reigned for 40 years. There's a lot of Bible history. So if you've got a lesson that's about 2 pages, there is just no way to go through and tell you all the things that happened. But I do have some cross-references that are not in your sheet. We'll look at those little by little and see. If you were to describe the kingdoms as far as after the United Kingdom, when it divides, there was what part of the kingdom? The upper section was called the Northern Kingdom. And the other section was called the Southern Kingdom, and divided up by the tribes. He says the most glorious part, this is lesson 7, the first paragraph at the top, the most glorious part of the history of Israel was the United Kingdom, and we can distinguish the United Kingdom from the divided kingdom, because, you know, united, they're all together, the north and south, and then the divided north splits off from the south, and the north didn't do as well in many respects as the south, and there's just a ton of Hebrew history there about both, though. It lasted from about 1095 to 975 B.C. So if you think about what we're talking about now, the United Kingdom, it's about 1,000 years before Jesus comes into the world. And then the Lord shows up and things begin to change. He mentions it includes the reigns of three great kings, Saul, David, and Solomon. When you start to look at the Bible, and this is hopefully one of the things that we're kind of putting together following our study in the book of Revelation, you find in the Bible that God had this great plan. And it's a plan which is revealed little by little, just as his word was revealed little by little. Think in terms of the nation of Israel. You get out of Egyptian bondage, you're wandering out there in the wilderness, and you finally got a tabernacle, a portable place to worship God. Doesn't that look like that's a big improvement from Egyptian bondage? You're thinking, wow, we're really living well now. You march forward a little bit in time, and that tabernacle, that portable place of worship, is replaced by what? Now you have a temple. And you're thinking, wow, we have really stepped things up. And then, lo and behold, Jesus comes into the world. What's he establish? His kingdom, his church. Again, you can kind of see that progression there with the idea of kingdom. You're out there in the wilderness, and now you've got, you know, land, and you've got the temple and so forth. He comes along, establishes his church, and now you think, wow, are we really doing great? We don't have to worry about a building anymore. We don't have to be a special group of people, anywhere we meet. We're God's people. And then, ultimately, this isn't the stage that we've yet come to, the kingdom is fulfilled ultimately in what sense? After the church, you've got heaven. So it's something that as you look back at Bible history, you can see this great plan of God. It has unfolded little by little. The revelation of it has been progressive. Abraham got a little information. The Bible characters got a little information. Finally, you get up to the time of Jesus and the apostles, and then finally there's going to be that great unveiling at the end of time. So God's plan is still, if you will, at least from our perspective, still unfolding. But it is a marvelous, wonderful plan that's amazing in every respect. He talks about the first king for the United Kingdom. This, of course, was Saul. He mentions that there were about 300 years when the 12 tribes of Israel had been loosely governed by judges. And that was part of that revelation. That was part of that preparation period, the unfolding, if you will. The last and greatest of these was who? The prophet Samuel. But the children of Israel wanted to be like their neighbors. Do we still have that problem today? People want to be like everybody else? Yeah. Can you think of some examples? All right, you have school kids. If they're going to dress, if they're going to behave in this way, they're going to be with the in crowd. And if not, it's not going to go so well. Peer pressure to conform. Where else? Want to be like our neighbors.
That saying, keeping up with the Joneses.
All right, you think about material things. If somebody has, a new car, we want a new car. Pick up a second car, pick up, a second house, look at my new bracelet, look at my new ring, look at my new TV, look at my new phone, look at my new computer. It just doesn't end. What else? Want to be like everybody else. What about in religion? A church over there, they just got this, that, or the other thing, and we need to, as Bonnie said, keep up with the Joneses. So it was a problem, it still is a problem, and when we come to spiritual things, it's a problem that we don't want to fall into, because that's one of Satan's traps. He says, under Saul, Israel's first king, but the children of Israel wanted to be like their neighbors. They came to Samuel, and what did they ask for? We need a king. Well, you can understand that if God had not been their leader, their king, then that probably would have made sense. But God makes the point, they've not rejected you, Samuel, they've rejected me. I've seen the nation through the things that we talked about earlier, and they, of course, just wanted that, head that they could see. God was very displeased with the request, but he instructed Samuel to anoint as their king a young man named Saul, who stood head and shoulders above the people. The people gathered at Mizpah and were presented with the new ruler, and yet, as that was done, it takes a little while, I guess, for anybody that gets a new job. But when Saul started out, what kind of person was he? Was he the fellow that just jumps up and says, all right, I'm ready to lead and rule? He was timid. And people sometimes start out that way today, and then they get their feet wet and become more comfortable, and sometimes they do well on the job and sometimes not. Thoughts that you have before we deal with the next section? Okay. He says there, this is kind of by that graphic on the right, it's the third paragraph, Saul began his reign pretty well, and he reigned for 40 years. Really easy to remember the reigns of the first three kings, Saul, David, Solomon, 40 years each time. And we've talked about Bible numbers in the past, and you can see there, I think, some of the significance that's involved in the number 40. Israel was beset by enemies, and he undertook the task of driving them back. He defeated who? There were the Ammonites and the Philistines, the Moabites and Edomites, among others. Soon he was quite popular among the people, but his popularity went to his head and he ceased to be a humble servant of God. That happens today, doesn't it? A person receives some power, a person receives some authority, and all of a sudden he or she thinks that he's God. It's happened in the church, sometimes it happens in the workplace, sometimes it happens in the school system, it's happened in the military. Bible talks about humility for a number of reasons, one of which is this. He becomes a self-willed individual. He's bent on doing things the way he wants them done, regardless of God's will. As I said, I do have some references here. 1 Samuel 10, 1 through 9, is a passage that I like read. It just so happens, and it wasn't, I guess, really in my mind, but it just so happens that this is also going to be a passage which is used in the morning lesson after a bit, so it's probably not going to hurt to hear it twice. But 1 Samuel chapter 10, verses 1 through 9, describes how things started off with Saul. And that's going to be something that can be contrasted with 1 Samuel 15 a little bit later. But let's look at it now. 1 Samuel 10, 1 to 9. Who's got that, Brian?
And Samuel took a vial of oil and poured it upon his head and kissed him and said, is it not because the Lord has anointed thee to be a captain over his inheritance? When thou departed from me today, then thou shalt find two men by Rachel's sepulchre in the border of Benjamin at Zelzah. I'll say to thee, the asses which thou wirest to seek are found, and lo, thy father hath left the cure of the asses in sorrow for you, saying, what shall I do for my son? Then shalt thou go forward from thence, and thou shalt come to the plain of Tabor, and there you shall meet the three men going up to God to Bethel, one carrying three kids, another carrying three loaves of bread, another carrying a bottle of wine. And give thee two loaves of bread, which thou shalt receive of thy hands. After that thou shalt come to the hill of God, which is in the garrison of the Philistines, and it shall come to pass, when thou art come further to the city, that thou shalt get a company of prophets coming down from the high place with a psaltery, a tabret, a pipe, and a harp before them, and they shall prophesy, and the Spirit of the Lord will come upon thee, and thou shalt prophesy with them, and shall be turned into another man. And let it be when these signs are coming to thee, that thou shalt that thou do as occasion serve thee, for God is with thee. And thou shalt go before me to Gilgal, but behold, I will come down unto thee and offer burnt offerings and sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days shalt thou tarry, but I come to thee and show thee what thou shalt do. And it was so that when he had turned his back to go to Samuel, God gave him another heart, and all his signs came to pass that day.
Okay, does it sound like you got off to a good start? God gives him another heart? God says, I'm going to be with you. God says, everything is going to work out okay. And then, if you will, Brian, turn over to 1 Samuel 15, 22 and 23. I'm going to ask you to read that in just a minute as well. The other thing there that I want to point out from 1 Samuel 10, and as I'm going to mention again in this morning's lesson, I think it's worthy of mentioning twice. In 1 Samuel 10, how long is Saul told to wait? 7 days. And he's told to wait for which person? Samuel. Is he able to do that?
He could.
No, 1 Samuel 10. 1 Samuel 10. Things, you know, he's been anointed. You're going to be the next king. Does he wait the 7 days? Is he able to do that?
Yes.
Yes. He is in 1 Samuel 10. Now take a look at 1 Samuel 15, 22 and 23. Okay, this is the same basic set of circumstances as far as waiting 7 days, but it's a different occasion. Wait 7 days. And what you have in 1 Samuel 15 is information that took place about 2 years after 1 Samuel 10. That's very interesting to me that in 1 Samuel 10 he can wait the 7 days. But now over in 1 Samuel 15, a couple years later, you've got the same deal. Wait 7 days. And does he wait the 7 days? Not fully. I mean, you get there and he's looking for Samuel. Samuel doesn't show up. And what's Saul say? We got a sacrifice. And Samuel's not here to do the sacrifice, so what's going
to
happen?
I'm
just going to have to do it myself. So it's kind of, in his mind, I guess, an emergency situation. And he does that, and that doesn't go so well. God says, I've rejected you. So, very interesting. He starts off so well, and he ends so badly. And we see that today, don't we, with a lot of people? You think about young people. They start off so well, start out with Bible class, and they start out learning about God, and they start out, you know, vacation Bible school, singing the songs and everything else. And then as the years go by, what happens? They just you know, fall off the ledge, if you will, spiritually. So it does happen sometimes. It happens for various reasons. And it is one of the things that happened to Saul. It was a very, very sad thing. Anything that you want to add or ask over that point? Okay. I had also in here 1 Samuel 31, verses 4 through 6. So if you turn over to 1 Samuel 10 and 15, that passage probably is not too far from where you are. Thinking about Saul and the trajectory that he was on, this takes us to the end of his life. And once again, it is not a pretty picture. 1 Samuel 31, 4 through 6. Somebody have that? Betty? It's pretty sad when a person comes to a time in life where, in modern society, they'd say, here's a gun, take it and shoot me, just kill me. And Saul has come to that time in his life, no guns available, but still a deadly weapon, a sword, and it's just run me through, kill me. And if you're not going to do it, then I'm going to take my own life, I'm going to commit suicide. But very interesting to see where this fellow went to as far as the height that he reached, and then you look at his life and you see, you know, where some of his choices led, and it just is a very, very sad end. But this is how, as far as just kind of a real quick overview, you know, Saul's life went. Had some good things, but also a bummer, if you will, when he began to make some bad choices. Again, any thoughts over his life that you want to add or ask? Okay, he says after, and this is the last full paragraph on the first page of our lesson, you have Saul's rejection. Though he was still reigning, God commanded Samuel to anoint privately his successor, a young shepherd boy named David, one of the greatest of all Bible characters. After his anointing, David was called on by Saul to play the harp for him whenever his spirit was troubled. Saul deeply loved him and selected him as his armor bearer. David quickly rose to prominence, and let's get a couple of helpers here lined up. 1 Samuel 16, that's going to be a longer reading, verses 1 through 7, 11 through 13, and then 1 Samuel 18, 6 through 9. Somebody want to, okay, Jeff, if you'll take the 1 Samuel 16 passage, verses 1 to 7, and then 11 to 13, and then who wants to be on deck for 1 Samuel 18, 6 to 9? Okay, Lois, 1 Samuel 18, verses 6 through 9. So you have here, Saul deeply loved him, selected him as his armor bearer. David quickly rose to prominence. He, of course, with that sling, slew the champion of the Philistines, Goliath, the giant. The ensuing glory gave David given to David, rather, provoked the jealousy of Saul, who began to suspect that David was trying to supplant, to replace him as king. From that time on, Saul sought to kill David and for years hunted him as an outlaw over the hills of Israel. Let's start with 1 Samuel 16, 1-7. Jeff?
The Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons." And Samuel said, "How can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me." And the Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord.' And invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. And you shall anoint for me him whom I declare to you." Samuel did what the Lord commanded him and came to Bethlehem. The elders of the city came to meet him trembling and said, "Do you come peaceably?" And he said, "Peaceably, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." And he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. When they came, he looked upon Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look upon his appearance or the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart."
Okay, I'm going to stop you there for just a second. Good reading. Thank you very much. A couple of things. Today, let's put it in the secular world first. If there is a company that loses its president, loses its basic leadership, you think people may panic? President was killed on the way in this morning. What are we going to do? Do you think people in the church can have that same mindset? We lost our elders. We lost our preacher. Well, we lost this family that was, you know, involved in all these things. We lost our treasurer. What are we going to do? Does God, or is God able to raise up replacement people? Yeah. It's not the end of the world. Is there anybody that is irreplaceable?
No.
Everybody can be replaced, and at some point, everybody is going to be replaced. So when those times happen, especially in the spiritual realm, we need to realize that God is still in control, and God can help his people. Then, too, you have this other great lesson from those first seven verses in the reading. Do you think that we're still guilty of what we read about here? We look and think, oh, he could not be used, she could not be used, they can't be used. What good are they going to be able to do? You know, you've got over here someone who's sick, what can he do? You've got over here a senior citizen, you know, what can she do? This one is too young, this one is too weak, this one knows too little about the Bible. Well, you know, sometimes those assessments are right and sometimes those assessments are not right. So some of the people that we might look upon as being very unproductive, being able to offer minimal assistance in the church, and the opposite is true, isn't it? Are there not some cases where you think, boy, this person is really going to be productive, this person is really going to be fruitful and useful, and then what do you get? A dud. I mean, it just doesn't work out very well. So always have to be mindful of that lesson and to remember God looks at the heart, but we oftentimes look at the exterior and we draw some conclusions that may or may not be right. Anything that you want to add or ask based on that point? Jeff, let's finish out the reading then, verses 11 to 13, 1 Samuel 16.
Then Samuel said to Jesse, "Are all your sons here?" And he said, "There remains yet the youngest, but behold, he is keeping the sheep." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Send and get him, for we will not sit down until he comes here." And he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. And the Lord said, "Arise, anoint him, for this is he." Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David from that day forward. And Samuel rose up.
Okay, we looked at the beginnings of Saul. Here you have really the beginnings of David. And from a human perspective, it was kind of like, you know, you could go back to the story of Joseph as well. You know, are you going to rule over us? When you look at people, it just seems like sometimes they just can't believe that a person can be effective or useful. But if you think back to what Isaiah had to say a long time ago, God says, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, and my ways are not your ways. My ways are higher than your ways." And that is absolutely right. Last paragraph on the page, he says, "Perhaps the most beautiful friendship in the Bible is that of David and Jonathan, the son of Saul." Very interesting that a lot of people in our day and time have very little regard for the Bible until they want to fuel their own evil agenda. You should know this if you don't. The story of Jonathan and David, how has that been twisted by people? All right, they would say that there was a same-sex relationship between the two. And that would not be the only Bible story that they would use to, or Bible example, I should say, to use to try to prove that point. But there have been some people that they have no use for the scriptures until they want to come and say, well, this activity is authorized by the Bible, a sinful activity. And it's often been used to do that, though that's not supported by the text. So you have here the Saul, the son of Saul, Jonathan, also realized that David was going to become king. So there's a great friendship. There's a very strong bond between the two. You have several times, several instances of Jonathan trying to save David from Saul's wrath, his ire. Saul and Jonathan both fall in battle. They die. And that prepares the way for David to be king. All right, top of next page, I have here another cross-reference from 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 30, verse 6. Is there anybody that's moderately close to that passage? All right, Josh, 1 Samuel 30, verse 6.
And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God.
Okay, now imagine being out there with your people, the people that are your friends, the people that are your companions, your associates, your fellow soldiers and so forth, and you know that they're talking about you. Well, you'd hope that they would say some things that are at least moderately favorable. But on this occasion, what are they saying about David, his associates? Let's go and kill him. Let's stone him. What would that be distressing to you? Well, yeah, it would. You know, you never know when somebody's going to come and try to knock you off. And you don't know which of your friends or which of your associates is going to be. As we look at David's life, and I think Saul's life, and even Solomon's life, we can look at these fellas, and we might be tempted to think, what kind of life did they have, good or bad? Good. I mean, you're king. You've got absolute rule, or you're on the road to the throne, and it looks like God has blessed you, and he's going to be with you and help you in every way, and yet they went through some very, very difficult times. Isn't that still true for leaders? People look at the president and sometimes may think, well, I'd like his job. You think President Obama's got his first share headaches? You look at the world right now, and it's not a fun place to try to have some influence in. What about in the church? You think the Bible class teacher has some headaches? You think the preacher has some headaches? You think the elders have some headaches? You think the wives of those people have some headaches? Yeah, they do. And yet people can sometimes look. It's the same thing out in the business world. You look and think, man, that supervisor, he's just got the easiest job in the world. I wish I had his job. Well, maybe not. Because responsibility usually comes with some headaches and some hardships. So David got his fair share of knocks. Some were self-imposed, some were not. But he did go through some struggles. Saul dies, David's crowned as king over the tribe of Judah. Saul's sorry son, Ishbosheth, reigned over the rest of Israel. Kingdom collapses after 7 years. David's authority is extended over the whole nation. He selects Jerusalem as his capital and set about the task of making Israel a great nation. He's also a man of blood. So in a successive war the writer talks about, and as you look at David's life, he was somebody that had a lot of blood on his hands. So much blood that God said, what about it? You're not going to build the temple. I mean, he was able to get everything lined up for that, but God said, that's not something that you're going to be permitted to do. So you've got in successive wars, he expanded the kingdom from the Nile to the Euphrates River, and then quoting from Acts chapter 13, verse 22, the Lord said of him, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, which shall fulfill all my will. Well, that was not literally true. There were some things. He was not a perfect man, but he was a man who really, for the most part, tried to live his life for God. You have David writing the Psalms, and as you read through some of the material that's in that book, you find a man who had some pretty deep feelings. There were times where it seems like, I mean, it's like peaks and valleys. You have a fellow, sometimes he just swooned. He was down there in the depths. And that was one of the reasons, I think this is one of the reasons why 1 Samuel 30, verse 6, God, my enemies are around me. God, they've surrounded me. God, it seems like everything is lost. It seems like everything is hopeless. And yet, in spite of how bad everything appears to be, where's my rock? Who's my salvation? Who's going to help deliver me? God. So it's kind of interesting to see how he responded to the problems of life. Saul, how did he end things? He decided, oh, just kill me. I'm going to follow my sword. But David, he is out there, he gets pressed and hurt on every side, and he says, God, you're my fortress, you're my rock, you're my deliverer. So two very different outlooks in life. And David is a great example in many respects. And then when times were good, would you say that David forgot about God? No. You look at passages like Psalm 23, goodness shall follow me in God's house, the Lord's house forever. You know, you prepare the table. So you have passages like that which reflect the fact that David was also a man of thanksgiving. So he had a wide range of emotions, but he always seemed to be focused on God regardless of the circumstances. And that's one of the great lessons that we can take from his life. Anything you want to add or ask based on what we said so far? Okay. He mentions in that paragraph with the bold text, you have a fellow who is really trying to be completely devoted to God. The consecration from David was especially evident in his constant willingness to obey God's commands. We may learn from him that we cannot expect the approval of God unless we're always willing to do what he asks, and that is without question. Well, you have David. He's the fellow who's doing well in a lot of different ways, prospers in battle, and it seems like things are moving right along, and then what happens? Becomes involved with, he commits adultery. You have the incident with Bathsheba, Uriah the Hittite's wife, and people have made different suggestions about that over the years. Time for battle. David didn't go out with battle. That probably wasn't the best choice on his part. But a fella who is really, really bright. I was in one of his classes one time at a lectureship, and he made this point, which I've thought of several times over the years. I've mentioned it a couple times here. We know it takes two to tango. And it may have been, since you've got Uriah out of town, you think the wife might have been looking for some company too? It's at least possible. We don't know that for sure. David should have, taken the lead there and said this is not going to be something that's explored or done. But it's possible that Bathsheba was out there, advertising, if you will, that she was available. So, as I said, it does take two. David certainly was the one who took the greater steps as far as the initiation, I guess, sent for and so forth. And then, she gets word back to him that she's pregnant, and then you've got a bad situation. So David decides that there's got to be a fix for this, and what's he do? Kind of put God there in the back burner. I'll take care of the matter, and how am I going to handle it? All right, we're going to kill the husband. So send him up to the front of the battle where the fighting is the heaviest, and it looks like he's a war casualty. I seriously doubt that's probably not the first and only time that that's happened. People have felt like we've got to get rid of this guy. We've got to get rid of this group of people. So let's figure out how we can, make it look like an accident or make it look like it was an act of war, and then we'll just cover it up. People do the same thing today as far as criminal activity. Let's make it look like he was trying to rob us or he was trying to shoot us or that he was the perpetrator. So this is an old tactic, an old technique. And then who showed up on David's doorstep with a little story? Yeah, we've got Nathan. Nathan, and he talks about the fellow with the little lamb and how precious it was and so forth. And Nathan lays out a great parable. And then David says what? Yeah, let's go after him. And Nathan says, thou art the man. So David was convicted. God knew exactly what he had done. And then you have the sword going through David's house in all kinds of bad ways. You have there the information in the middle of the paragraph. David did repent, but he had lots of troubles. Absalom, that son, murdered his own brother. Then you've got the revolt from Absalom. Then you've got David fleeing for a time. Adonijah tries to take the kingdom, and he gets some help from Joab, one of David's generals, a trusted source, to keep the kingdom falling into the wrong hands. You've got Solomon crowned king while David is still living, and it's just a mess. So Saul had his fair share of issues. David had his fair share of issues. Still some great times. And then you turn to Solomon, and he also reigned for 40 years, but he had his fair share of problems as well. I did have down here 2 Samuel chapter 12, verses 7 through 13. I would like that read, and then we'll get two other readers lined up, one in a little bit for 1 Kings chapter 3, and then somebody for Nehemiah chapter 13. In just a minute, 2 Samuel 12, 7 to 13. We'd like to, all right, 2 Samuel 12, verses 7 to 13, Lois. 1 Kings 3, we'd like that one read. 1 Kings 3, verses 7 to 10. Anybody want to take that? 1 Kings 3, 7 to 10? Okay. And then Nehemiah 13, 23 to 26 in a bit. Jeff, Nehemiah 13, 23 to 26. Let's start with 2 Samuel chapter 12, 7 to 13.
Nathan then said to David, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, it is I who anointed you king over Israel, and it is I who delivered you from the hand of Saul. I also gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your care, and I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have added to you many more things like these. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the sons of Ammon. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he shall lie with your wives in broad daylight. Indeed, you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and under the sun." Then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And Nathan said to David, "The Lord also has taken away your sin. You shall not die."
Okay, very good reading, and thank you very much. If you listen to the first part of that, God says, I. You had a great life in many respects, but it's great because of me. Putting that into our day and time, could God say, "I've given you this and this and this and this and this"? Yes, he could. I mean, just living in this country is a great, great blessing. And we may not do the exact thing that David did, but if we respond to God in a way that is not very grateful, should we expect to fare very well? No. So God says, "I've done this for you, and if this, David, had not been enough, I would have done even more. And this is the way," we might say, to use modern terminology, "you've repaid me. This is the way that you've responded. And now things are not going to go well for you." So when we think about our spiritual responsibilities, the things that God has told us to do, we want to make sure that we try to do those things, because God says that he's been kind to us, and now it's time for us to respond in the appropriate way. Again, anything that you want to add or ask before we turn to Solomon? Okay, talking about this next Bible character, this third king of the United Kingdom, he talks about, once again, he starts off so well, just in many ways as Saul and David had started off very well. Solomon begins with wisdom and turns to idolatry. Let's have that reading, 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 7 to 10.
"And now, O Jehovah, my God, thou hast made thy servant king instead of David, my father, and I am but a child, little child. I know not how to go out or come in. And thy servant is in the midst of thy people, which thou hast chosen, a great people that cannot be numbered nor counted for multitude. Give thy servant, therefore, an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this thy great people?" And the speech pleased the Lord to Solomon and asked this thing.
Okay. You think about the beginnings. Let's go back to Saul for a second and recap with him. Where's Saul? He's timid, or he's bold. He's hiding there among the baggage. So, again, has a great quality of humility. Starts out in a good way. What about David? One of the big strapping sons of Jesse, and oh yeah, he's a logical choice. You know, he wasn't even in the first group that was called. It was, no, you know, there's no way he can be. And now with Solomon comes along, and he says, "God, I'm but a child. You know, this is just too great for me." And it just is so sad. You see people today, they start out so well. A young child is so obedient in the younger years. You see a new Christian. He or she starts out with enthusiasm, and they're on the right road, and everything is great. And then, for some reason, they just fall off the map. Well, one of the lessons I would take from that is it's great to see that kind of person begin in a good way, whether it's a child or whether it is maybe an adult who's become a Christian. What things can we do because we know that people can get off track to the point where they just fall off the map spiritually. What are some of the things that we can do to keep people on that right track? Young folks and old folks.
Train them up right.
All right. There needs to be that additional instruction that's given, whether it's a young person or whether it's someone who's become a Christian. Encouragement to continue to live in the right way. That's going to be one of the key things, right?
And regular fellowship with other good-minded people.
All right. Evil companionships, speaking about false teachers, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33, Paul said, evil companionships corrupt good morals, corrupt morals. Bad companions are going to put you on the wrong road. So, yes, the training, the fellowship with fellow saints, that's something that needs to be done. Anything else?
Continue teaching.
All right. There needs to be additional instruction, trying to put as much Bible into the heads of our young people as we can. You know, we've done that a little bit with Lads to Leaders. We're kind of gearing up for that. With new Christians, again, you know, here's some devotional material. We've got that in a lot of different forms, electronic as well as printed. What else can we do?
Let somebody know that we're thinking of
them. All right, and praying for them. And that's part of the encouragement, but that's a distinct part of the encouragement to say, we're praying for you. The world's a difficult place. Being a new Christian as an adult out there in the work world, it's a difficult thing. We're here to talk if you want to talk, but we don't also want you to know that we're praying for you on a regular basis. So those should be some of the lessons that we pick up from today's study. Solomon's rule, he says, was in sharp contrast with his father's. David had faced turmoil for almost his entire reign, but Solomon, he comes along. You know, who was the fellow that was in one of the movies? I'm a lover, not a fighter. Anybody remember that line from a movie? Well, there are people like that today. There are some guys, you know, they're out there, they're rough, they're tough, they're always willing to brawl. And the other guy, you know, I'm a lover, not a fighter. Let's just all get along. That's kind of how Solomon strikes me. So he does have great peace during his reign. He's got the dream that we talked about as far as, you know, I don't want riches, God, I want you know, wisdom. Didn't seek the honor, and God blesses him greatly. The wisdom that he had was is demonstrated to us by his writings, also demonstrated in some of the Bible stories that we have about him. How many Proverbs did he write? 3,000. Do we have them all? No, just a fraction of them. How many songs? 1,005. A lot of his wisdom is recorded in you know, some of the Bible books that we have, which we'll look at a little bit later, the wisdom literature. And he just was a smart guy, had a lot of money, and he drove Israel to its greatest height. And it did become a world power. He mentions the wealth of Solomon. If we put it in today's terms, it is astounding. 1,400 chariots. Now, that might not sound like that much. But, you know, in that day and time, did they probably have a factory down the road where they're just cranking out chariots every day? No? So that would have taken some time and some money. And then you've got 12,000 horsemen. Well, you know, that's a nice number. But if you've got 12,000 horses or 12,000 horsemen without horses, that's a little bit of a problem, isn't it? So if you've got 12,000 horsemen, you should have at least 12,000 horses. And I've never housed a horse, but I do know that they like to eat. And I do know that there is some upkeep as far as a stable, so that would have taken a great deal of money. And he mentions his annual income equivalent to how much money? $20 million a year. How much did he get taxed on that? Okay, you're the king, so you don't have to worry about taxes, tax-free. And then you have, you know, some of his gifts, $3.5 million, to the Queen of Sheba. She went to see if the reports about him were true. And what did she say? They were. She hadn't been told the half of what people, you know, had experienced from this man. So the stories, it's just amazing. And sometimes you wish we had maybe a whole book about some of the examples from Solomon's mind. He mentions in that last paragraph, the greatest of all Solomon's accomplishments was his building of the temple. That, of course, was to replace the tabernacle in which Israel had worshipped since the wilderness. That goes back to that progression that we talked about earlier. Likely no structure in the world's history has equaled it in cost. Built by how many people? 183,000 people. I'm not sure what the population of Fort Wayne is. I'm thinking it's somewhere around that number. So you just imagine the entire population coming out for 7.5 years. And everybody in that city is used to build this temple project. It was a terrific number of people. And it cost from how much? $2 to $5 billion. Even in today's world, in our economy, you know, $1 billion, it's still a pretty good amount of money. Now, sometimes they'll say, well, we need $1 billion for this, $1 billion for that. But it's still a ton of money. And certainly in that day and time, it was a lot. The great wealth of Solomon, though, eventually led to his undoing. Let's take a look at Nehemiah 13, 23 to 26.
In those days also I saw the Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And half their children spoke the language of Ashdod, and they could not speak the language of Judah, but only the language of each people. And I confronted them, and cursed them, and beat some of them, and pulled out their hair. And I made them take oath in the name of God, saying, you shall not give your daughters to their sons, or take their daughters for your sons, or for yourselves. Do what, 26?
Yeah.
Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women? Among the many nations, there was no king like him, and he was beloved by his God, and God made him king over Israel, over all Israel. Nevertheless, foreign women made even him to sin.
All right, Nehemiah sounds like he was more of a fighter than a lover. But you have a fella here, you know, actually pulling out, hair from people. And that statement he makes about Solomon, what led him away? Married all those foreign women. Goes back to what Brian said earlier, evil companionships corrupt good morals. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 33. So Solomon entered into those relationships. God had warned in advance of Solomon's time, if you have a king, do not let him, marry a bunch of foreign women, getting a bunch of horses. God said, don't do some things that Solomon did, and he failed to do those things. So he sought every kind of pleasure, 700 wives, 300 concubines. I'm thinking even if he spent, a little time with them throughout the year, what amount of time did he have for anything else? Trying to spend some time with 1,000 people, just almost unbelievable. Now, some of those were political alliances, so there may not have been much there as far as association, but still, you've got 1,000 spouses, if you will, or 1,000 people that are joined to you in some sense as far as marriage is concerned. Most of these were idolaters, and what a time he must have had in trying to please them all. It can be tough trying to please one spouse, can it? Husband to wife, wife to husband?
Yeah.
Well, imagine 2 or 20 or just 100 spouses. 1,000, and religiously they're on a different page. Today we see marriages split up because people are not on the same page religiously. And you've got 1,000 women, probably with 1,000 different ideas. So it was an interesting life that he had. He goes on to say his high cost of living led him to tax the people heavily, much to their dissatisfaction. His reign had started with wisdom and wealth, it ended with women and idolatry. Again, started off so well and ended so badly. When his 40-year rule ended, he was a thoroughly disillusioned and unhappy man. In his revelry, he had laid the groundwork for the division of his great kingdom after his death, and we'll talk more about that as far as the divided kingdom in the next lesson. Anything that you want to add or ask over what we've talked about? All right, let's run through the answers. Who was the first king of Israel? Saul. Had 700 wives? Solomon. He was a man after God's own heart? Correct. His son Absalom led a revolt against him? David. He stood head and shoulders above the people? Saul. Samuel announced the people at Mizpah that he was the new king? Saul, he announced too. During his reign, the temple was built. Solomon. On the occasion, he was visited by the Queen of Sheba. Solomon. Who had a son named Jonathan? Saul. Who sinned by taking for his wife Bathsheba?
David.
Samuel instructed Saul to utterly destroy who? The Amalekites. See. Saul spared some of the animals and the king. It wasn't all the animals, and C is also wrong. Saul's action displeased God. When unnoticed by God, or pleased God? Displeased God. He lost the kingdom. Samuel said that which pleased the Lord was more... Okay, very good. Obedience, C. Because of his action, Saul was rejected as king. Then on the back page, as we look at the answers, which are fill in the blank, the Philistines gathered to battle the men of Israel. They had a champion, and his name was Goliath. The staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spearhead weighed 600. And there again, you get into that number 6, which we've talked about. Not a good number. He dared the Israelites to send out a man to fight him. The 3 eldest sons of Jesse, the father of David, were in Saul's army. But David had to take care of his father's sheep. On a certain day, his father sent David to Saul's army with corn, loaves of bread, and cheeses. When David had arrived, he heard the challenge of Goliath and asked to fight him. This made the brother named Eliab angry with him. David's brave words were heard by Saul. He sends for David. He gave him his armor and helmet of brass for his head. So they were familiar with metalworking and weaponry. David selected how many stones? 5 smooth stones. And then when the stone was flung, it struck Goliath in the forehead. Thank you. Stan, I'm going to ask you and Brian, or you and Josh, to distribute these for next week. Thank you very much. We're done.